Inside the Huddle with Sky Sports, Neil Reynolds and Jeff Rimbo.
Yes, hello and welcome to Inside the Huddle in association with SkySports.com and NFL UK. I'm your host, Neil Reynolds, and up bright and early in Canada is my partner from Sky Sports coverage of the NFL, Jeff Reinbold. Jeff, good morning. What time is it? Do you even know what day it is? What time it is?
All I know is it's the day before, which is what we, in coaching parlance, I guess, is, you know, the day before you play your game. So you usually travel the day before you play. We go to Montreal for a big Thursday night game. And so this morning we're getting ready to go on the field for our last practice, you know, last active physical practice before we play.
Excellent. All right, good stuff. So we are going to talk a little bit of news around the NFL. We're going to give you our top five, three, four defensive ends. Jeff, I'm not in a cupboard today, but I am in the NFL UK offices and they're painting. And I tell you what, the fumes are overwhelming. I will be high as a kite, although not officially, by the end of this podcast. It's like heady days here, I'm telling you. It's good stuff. can't be a bit of gloss. So the franchise tags are going to be signed or hopefully signed this week. I don't think we'll talk too much about that because by the time people listen to this podcast, things will have moved on. But you know, we hopefully will if you're a fan of the Denver Broncos. You know, there's significant differences between Denver and Demaryius Thomas at the moment. Dez Bryant has called the Cowboys Stephen Jones personally and has threatened to hold out. There's no progress between Kansas City and Justin Houston. And, of course, there's significant animosity between Jason Pierre-Paul and the New York Giants. So we'll kind of park that franchise tag stuff now. Jeff, the one thing I wanted to talk about was the sad news that came late last week. Kenny Stabler, one of the greatest quarterbacks, probably not in the Hall of Fame, actually, but I'm sure you have fond memories of him. I never met Kenny Stabler, but I met many times his running mate, Fred Biletnikoff, and some of the stories Fred told were the stuff of legend. But Kenny Stabler, the old Raiders quarterback, sadly died last week of colon cancer, age 69. Your thoughts on him?
Well, you know what? There's a guy that certainly does, in my mind, belong in the Hall of Fame. He won a Super Bowl. He was, you know, a part of, you know, at that time, one of the most successful franchises. It was a dynasty, the Raiders, in those days. They won. They were the winningest pro sports franchise of any in any sport at their time, at their heyday. And he was the, you know, he was really the driving force of it all. You know, I remember so vividly. Here's a guy who, playing in the National Football League on Sundays, he's got a yellow smiley decal on the front of his helmet. Mm. And, you know, how he got away with that, how the NFL ever let him get away with that is, you know, can you imagine being a middle linebacker walking up to the line of scrimmage and you look across, there's the quarterback with no chin strap on and a yellow smiley a decal on the front of his helmet. Just, I mean, that was Snake. That was, he was, you know, again, Freddie, you mentioned Freddie's quote last time about how he studied the playbook by the light of the jukebox in some honky-tonk. Hmm. You know, I heard Dave Casper say this week that it was incredible. His football knowledge was absolutely incredible. They would give him the game plan. He'd kind of thumb through it and then put it in the trash can, and you know, away they'd go for some adventure during the week. But on Sundays, when it counted, he could always play. And you know, you measure quarterbacks by wins, and certainly he was a winner. And then you also measure them by, you know, what they do at the, you know, the high pressure moments, those critical moments when they have to deliver. And that's maybe when Stabler was at his best.
Yeah, one of the very first American football books I read was Stabler's book, The Snake, and you, the stories just jump off the page. You know, I mean, he certainly took every advantage of being an NFL quarterback and a star one at that. But Jeff, it's kind of interesting because we do, you know, we kind of laugh and joke about the stories. And actually, if you go onto the internet now and Google Kenny Stabler, you'll see updated stories where people are telling how he was, you know, a game where he was playing for Houston Oilers and he was out all night drinking. He threw four interceptions in the first half. Bum Phillips tore him off a strip at halftime. He threw up in the bathroom, then came back and threw four second half touchdowns. I mean, this is the kind of story you get with Kenny Stabler. But now, if he played in today's age, he'd be considered a problem child. He would be all over Twitter. Social media would be, you know, going bonkers. He'd probably be suspended 4 or 5 games every season. It's changed, hasn't it?
Yeah, the game has changed and the world's changed. You know, it was such a different time. And, you know, it was the media's changed.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's so much more media and there's so much more focus. And actually, the media is more intrusive than they ever were. There was kind of a time back, and he was just at the end of it, when there was kind of an unwritten agreement between players and the media that, you know, the media, you know, would hide certain things that guys were doing, you know, in the interest of, you know, getting stories. And yeah. Now that's all changed because it's so competitive and they're in these guys' lives 24/7 and TMZ and all the other things that are going on. So it certainly would have been a different time. And I watched Phil Villapiano, who played linebacker on those teams with the Raiders last night, talking about Stabler and you know, their moments together and how close that team was. And it was a lot of that was forged in those adventures that they would get into off the field. And John Madden, who was the head coach of that team, I guess gave them a lot of room and treated them like men. And, you know, the whole thing was, and it came from Mr. Davis from upstairs, just win, baby.
Yeah, they backed it up.
That's what they did.
Yeah, they backed it up.
They would go out. Yeah, they would go out and they would deliver on Sundays. And for Mr. Davis, that was the important thing, that you know, when you came to work on Sundays, that you could perform and those guys could perform. Now, think back on how interesting it would have been at the University of Alabama when your starting quarterback is Joe Namath and your backup quarterback is Kenny Stabler. There wouldn't be a female within 4 states that was there.
Never have you spoken a truer word on this podcast, Mr. Reinbold. But, I mean, there was an aura about that Raiders team. And I guess, you know, you'll remember that team that ran roughshod throughout the NFL, Jeff, more than most of us. I know you were very, you know, partial to the Raiders growing up. But that sense of rebellion, that sort of sneaking out during training camp, and you know, probably they were probably drinking among the journalists when they were out. Well, you know, we don't know if Madden turned a blind eye. He probably did because they were winning, but it must have created a tight team as well.
Yeah, it did, and it's kind of a fine line, really. You know, teams that spend time together off the field, you know, they tend to get closer. And, you know, again, but it was a different time, and there weren't guys making the kind of money that they're making today. And I think that the teams in general were probably closer back in those days because, you know, they were all kind of in that same boat. Now you have the superstars who have all the money, and, you know, one of the problems in the NFL is the rookies who aren't making that kind of money are trying to keep up with the veterans, and, you know, that's created another, you know, issue. But go back to that day, and you go back to that team, particularly that Raiders team, and in an era when there was no free agency, you were able to keep that team together. Now, Stabler went on and played for the, you know, for the Oilers, took him to the playoffs, and played for the, finished up with Bum in New Orleans. But, you know, he was the head. I mean, he was the quarterback there for a run of years. And Biletnikoff played his whole career there. Cliff Branch played his whole career there. Dave Casper played his whole career there. Jim Otto, the center, played his whole career there. Upshaw, all of those guys stayed together and played together. You don't see that in today's NFL because of free agency and the movement, which, you know, I'm happy for the players because they get that movement.
Yeah.
But back in those days, you know, you put a team together and you could count on that team being together. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why the Raiders got on a roll like they did. And the whole mystique, you talk about the mystique of that team and those silver and black uniforms. You know, Chuck Knoll called the Raiders secondary the criminal element in the NFL. I mean, that was Jack Tatum and Willie Brown, and, you know, it was George Atkinson. I mean, they were something back there. Lester Hayes. But that team just had, you know, just an amazing collection of characters on it. And, you know, as if you were a Raider fan, it was, you know, it was it was an amazing time. I think back now, the defining moments in my mind in that franchise's history, it was when they played Philadelphia in the Super Bowl, and it was almost like good against evil.
Yeah.
You know, Coach Vermeil's Philadelphia team, you know, all kinds of rules, you know, curfew, you know, long practices, the whole deal, and on the kind of a military approach to the thing. And then on the other side, there's Madden's Raiders, and they're out on Bourbon Street. Matusak misses practice during the week. I mean, just all the stuff going floating around about it. And then game day comes, and they just absolutely dismantled Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And in one of the more lopsided, you know, Super Bowl wins.
Yeah, I remember spending some time last year ahead of the Wembley game with Fred Biletnikoff, George Atkinson, Ted Hendricks. And, Jeff, they were so fondly remembering those days playing. And Kenny Stabler was a centerpiece of that, and he died last week, age 69. Let's move on to some other news from around the NFL. And Thomas Davis has been in the UK, Carolina Panthers linebacker, and he was working with a lot of kids, Jeff, doing some grassroots activity for the NFL. And I got the chance to speak to Thomas about, you know, the fact that he's the NFL Man of the Year, being a role model. And how he feels when players create negative headlines. So let's just have a listen to a little bit of my chat with Thomas Davis of the Carolina Panthers.
You talk about doing things the right way and being a role model. Does it frustrate you then, and I know this from interviewing a lot of players, there are a ton of good guys in the NFL, really good guys who are great role models, but then there are people that get the headlines for the wrong reasons. Without naming names, we don't need to get into specifics, but does it frustrate you when you see those headlines?
Oh, it's very frustrating. And the reason is so frustrating because there are so many places and things that players can be doing, you know, to kind of offset some of the stuff that's going on in the league during the offseason and during the season. I feel like if guys volunteered their time more, if they did more in the community, that would take away from some of that free time that they had to, you know, really go out and make those mistakes. Mm. And at a very young age, we're all taught what to do, right from wrong. So we all know. We know when you're being put in a compromising position, or if you know when things are heading down the wrong path, that it's time for you to get out of there. I mean, guys just get so caught up with thinking that they can get away with certain things. Mm. But if you look at the news week in and week out, it happens. You're getting caught. So at some point, we have to realize that, you know, right, wrong, or indifferent, you know, we have a target on our backs. Mm. And it's up for us to, you know, do with that information that we see fit. So it's important for us to take advantage of it and know that we have to use this platform for the right reason.
So there he is, Thomas Davis. Jeff, there's a reason that this guy is the reigning NFL Man of the Year and somebody we should be looking up to.
Well, I tell you what, you just made me a Thomas Davis fan, or Thomas Davis just made me a Thomas Davis
yeah.
fan. And I hope if there was any way that every player in the National Football League could hear that message and, you know, recognize that, you know, I know, you know, Charles Barkley says that I'm no role model, I'm a pro athlete. Well, yeah, that's true, but the reality of it is there's a lot of young eyes that look up to you, and a lot of, you know, older eyes, too, that look up to those guys. Mm. They have a responsibility in their community. They have a responsibility to the National Football League. It's a, you know, we say this all the time, you know, it's a right. It's a privilege. It's not a right to play in the National Football League. It's a privilege. It's not a right to be a part of the National Football League. And, you know, you're looked at differently. And Aaron Cromer, you know, is finding that out right now. The offensive line coach from the Buffalo Bills, who got himself in some trouble down in Florida during their break on Sunday, and you know, he's going to have to be held accountable. I mean, you cannot, and when you are part of the National Football League, you cannot underestimate the focus that is put on you and the scrutiny that you're under, but also with that. Like Thomas Davis, when you are a guy who does good, you can do so much good. And I think, you know, give me those Thomas Davis stories. Those are the ones that I think the NFL needs desperately right now.
And Jeff, I think you kind of reap what you sow as a player as well. And because Thomas has been such a good locker room player in Carolina, such a leader of that team, that actually helped him and pretty much saved his career. He mentioned in another part of the interview, don't forget he suffered torn ACL to the same right knee 3 years in a row. And as he mentioned, if he'd been even a hint of problem in the locker room, a hint of a disappointment to Jerry Richardson, that team would have given up on him, because it's very easy to give up on a player that's had, you know, one ACL, let alone three in a row, 3 years in a row. But because Thomas was such a good guy, that kind of saved him and gave him another opportunity, and he's absolutely taken full advantage, 3 years in a row, over 100 tackles. But you know, that was pleasing to hear, that actually being a good guy, being a good stand-up guy in the locker room, saved his career and gave him another chance.
Yeah, you know what? This is true, and again, I'm going back to my first experience, you know, talking in pro football, and Coach Vermeil saying to the players, your ability will buy you time, but when your ability begins to wane, it's the other things that will keep you around. And what he was saying was, if you're a problem, if you're a PIA, as we refer to them, if you're a PIA and you're a problem guy and you're a locker room issue and you're in the community, you know, getting screwing up and you're, you know, embarrassment to the league and to your franchise, you're going to be the first one to go.
Yeah,
because you know they'll put up with that stuff for a while as long as you're producing on the field. But when your production begins to wane, you can rest assured that you're going to be out the door. If you're a good guy and you're a positive guy in the locker room, that will buy you time through those kinds of experiences. Because, you know, they could have very easily, Carolina could have played the percentages and said, okay, second ACL on the same knee, you know, he'll never come back. Let's cut him, let's cut him and save ourselves some money and move on. Well, because Thomas Davis is such a great guy and he means so much in that locker room, you keep a guy like that around, because even if he never comes back, every day he's around a young player, every day he's around his teammates, he's making that football team better.
Yeah, absolutely. One other piece of news, Jeff, and it kind of comes, I've got a question from the mailbag from Adam Nichols, who said, do you have any inside knowledge on the chances of the Packers coming to London in 2016? The buzz is building. I also got that from Lewis Wilson. So last week in Jacksonville, there was a report in one of the Jacksonville newspapers, and it was pretty speculative stuff. It was speculating that the Jags will extend their commitment to London another 4 years when the current one runs out. And it also speculated that the Green Bay Packers would be Jacksonville's opponents in 2016. So I'll answer this question. Do I have any inside knowledge? No, I don't. And that's genuine. I don't have any inside knowledge. But I will tell you this. I've interviewed Aaron Rodgers in the past, and Aaron Rodgers is very keen to play a game in London and is very aware of what's happening with the NFL internationally. And Packers president Mark Murphy, who of course was a old safety for the Washington Redskins, and I think might have played over here back in the American Bowl series, but I've interviewed Mark a couple of times when I was covering games at Lambeau Field, and he came into the press box and spoke with us on BBC Radio. And I know that Mark Murphy is a big supporter of what the NFL does internationally. So I have no inside information, but those are two pretty powerful people in the Packers organization.
Those are all positive signs. And, you know, it's like I say, it's so good right now to hear so much positive information. And, you know, I saw a tweet the other day on my Twitter account from Nick Mangold, where he said he was looking forward to bringing his family to the UK to spend some time around the, you know, Jets UK people. And, you know, when you see those things starting to happen independently of, you know, press releases from the National Football League, I think those are all positive signs for what's going on in the UK. And you know, the stadium thing with the Tottenham Hotspurs is a positive in my mind, and just more and more and more good news. And it's just right now the best time to be an NFL fan in the United Kingdom because there's so much NFL coming to you.
Yeah, we've got six players heading into London this week, and they're going to be out at a Summer Bowl event. The NFL's Play 60 program is culminating tomorrow in London with about 360 kids taking part in flag football finals, which is going to be incredible. And we've got six players coming over for that, all from the competing teams that will be at Wembley Stadium this year. And then in addition, we've got Menelik Watson making a return to the UK. Always welcome back the Oakland Raiders tackle. So there's lots going on in the UK, even though it's a relatively quiet time in the NFL in the United States. So now we're going to move on and look at our top five 3-4 defensive ends. So obviously you have different systems in the NFL. We're looking at the defensive ends in a three-man front. And Jeff, first of all, put your coach's hat on and give us an explanation of a difference between a 3-4 defensive end and a 4-3 defensive end. And are we talking differences in just what they're asked to do, or are they different body types as well?
Well, when you're talking about the 3-4, and you know, let's go back in history, and you look at the teams that were built with the 3-4, the Giants, you know, I think were the first one to really be good at it with Parcells and Belichick, and then now everybody does some of it, and some teams are more into it than others. The Steelers have always been really, probably the most ironclad 3-4 unit, but I think the thing you look for in those guys, the first thing is they've got to be able to what we call two gap, and that's where they can play both gaps on either side of them. Just to talk a little football this morning, when you look at an offensive formation, the gap, if you will, between the two offensive linemen, so between the center and the guard, between the guard and the tackle, between the tackle and the tight end, we refer to those as gaps. Now, in 4-3 defense, you typically have one man for one gap.
Yep.
But one of the things that makes the 3-4 so unique is typically those three down linemen, the guys who put their hands on in the dirt, are responsible for both gaps on either side of them. So it takes a different kind of guy. And usually, as you mentioned, the body style of those guys is a little bit different. They tend to be thicker, squattier, stronger, bigger guys, and they're playing more on the line of scrimmage than upfield across the line of scrimmage.
But, Jeff, has it changed a little bit? Because if I think back not that long ago, Brett Kiesel would be a classic example of the Pittsburgh Steelers. His role as that 3-4 defensive end was get in the way, get down and dirty, make things difficult, allow the linebackers around you to make the plays. It was very much that, you know, in the same way I guess Justin Smith did that a little bit and helped Alden Smith become a better pass rusher. It was more of that, what you do and how you disrupt the defensive line helps the linebackers make plays around you. But now we're looking at J.J. Watt. 51.5 sacks in the past 3 years. Sheldon Richardson of the Jets, he had 8 sacks last year. So has it changed a little bit from how it was a few years back?
Well, the systems a little bit have changed, and as guys have kind of morphed the defense around, when you look at the standard 3-4 teams, and I'm talking about the Steelers are the first one that comes to mind, and then any place that Wade Phillips has coached is the second place where you look. You find those teams, and I'm really glad you brought up Brett Kiesel, because when you talk about this position, here is a guy, Kiesel, that comes out of BYU. He's not physically what you look for typically in a defensive lineman. He's not a quick twitch guy. He's not a great pass rusher. He's not, fluid in his hips, all the things that the scouts look for. He didn't have. But what he did have was tremendous discipline and great hands. He had incredible hands. And so inside, in that system, he could function extremely well. I'll give you, for Pittsburgh Steelers fans will remember this name, and they had a guy from Hawaii. Actually, was from Kauai. He played at Boise State. A kid named Kimo Van Olfhausen. Mm. And Kimo was that defensive end in those, in some really, really good Steeler defenses, and played extremely well. Was a Pro Bowl caliber player. Goes to the Jets as a free agent and gets put in the 4-3. And just really disappears. I mean, in 2 years later, he's out of the NFL. So his skill set, like Kiesel's, was very much suited to the 3-4. Mm. They were guys that were not great athletes per se. You wouldn't look at them and say, when you go to the combine, boy, you got to watch Kimo Van Olfhausen. That's not what you're going to see. But when you play the game, that's when they stood out, and they were so technically sound and so assignment sound, and they played so well in that system that it does require a different guy. Now JJ Watt, let's be honest about JJ Watt. JJ Watt could play in the radar defensive. He'd be a great player. I mean, he is special. Now what Wade did when he got him was he kind of morphed the system and really gave him an opportunity to make more plays. So he plays more one gap in a two gap system. And, he's just one of those rare guys that can do that. But, you start talking about these players, and Justin Smith, rather, is the guy to me that, I think about. Mm. And, how strong he was and how physical he was. And, like I say, you can imagine how hard it is to have a 300-pound man come off and trying to reach your outside shoulder. And you have to get your hands inside his chest and bench him off and play not only the gap outside of you, but the gap inside of you if the running back cuts back. And that's you're asking an awful lot of a guy. So these guys are special, special kinds of guys. It's hard for me when you talk about these guys. Obviously, JJ goes, he's in his class all by himself. Hmm. And then below them, these are kind of unsung guys. They're guys that maybe don't have big numbers. Now, you mentioned Mo Wilkerson. Mo Wilkerson is, again, not to the J.J. Watt level, but he is certainly one of those guys who can transition from a two-gap player into a one-gap player pass rusher.
Yeah, so we're going to try and tackle our 3-4 defensive ends against the backdrop, as Jeff said, that they tend to morph now, these systems. I remember speaking to Jimmy Tomsula, who said, I challenge the layman to be able to tell whether we're in 3-4 or 4-3 sometimes. And Jeff, that's the whole point, isn't it? You're not gonna, unless you're Wade Phillips, like you say, strong believers in the 3-4. There is going to be flexibility in every NFL defense, isn't there? That's the whole point. You don't want to be obvious about what you're doing defensively and lining up the same way play after play.
No, and you're exactly right, Neil. And as the game has changed, and it continues to evolve. Now, I'm a 3-4 guy, and like I said, Wade and I are writing a book on the 3-4. Hmm. The thing that what offenses have forced you to do today with all of the four wide receiver sets that you see, is you have to have a really good nickel package. And typically, when you get into your nickel, you take out your nose tackle and put in another defensive back. Well, that then means that you're really playing those what were defensive ends are now defensive tackles, and their ability to rush the passer in those situations is critical. So, if you look at a team, how a team's built now in the National Football League, they will have a few of those, wide bodies, space eaters, to stop the run when you get the tight end sets and the fullback sets, the standard NFL, formations, personnel groups, and then get those guys out typically after first down when all the little guys come in, then you bring your smaller pass rushers in. That's, again, one of the things that makes Watt so amazing. Mm. He can play either of those systems. He can play two gap, and then he can also, when it's time to rush the passer, he can get in a gap and beat a tackle or beat a guard one-on-one.
All right, so I'll give you my top five then, and then you can weigh in with yours, Jeff, and these, we can give explanations for them because, as we say, there's some gray areas to these positions. I'm going to start off number five would be Fletcher Cox of the Philadelphia Eagles. I thought he came on really strong at the back end of last year, a real battler who fights from start of every play to the end. I like Fletcher Cox a lot, and I think he's a rising star. I've got Mo Wilkerson at number four from the New York Jets. At number three, I've got Calais Campbell of the Arizona Cardinals. I think he is one of those classic examples of being a complete nuisance along the defensive line. Long athlete, really long, tall. But he doesn't always put up the big numbers. But I think somebody you have to account for on every play. He was already pretty high on my list. And then when I went to Miami last month and interviewed Ndamukong Suh, and I asked him who he thought the best defensive linemen were in the business, Suh actually said Calais Campbell was top of his list. So that made me sit up and take notice. At number two, I've got Sheldon Richardson of the New York Jets. Again, rising star, I think. Very confident, believes in his own hype and ability, but does back it up on the field. And then it's an obvious one, as I'm sure you'll have as well, in a class by himself, is J.J. Watt of the Houston Texans. So that's my five, Jeff. It's Fletcher Cox, Mo Wilkerson, Calais Campbell at three, Sheldon Richardson at two, and J.J. Watt out in front by some distance at number one. What have you got?
You know what? I'm very, very similar. I'm very, very similar. I'm a big Fletcher Cox fan, too, and I, for the very same reasons that you talk about, Neil. Great effort guy. Great toughness, you know, a guy that's going to, if you're going to play 60 minutes, he wants to play 65. I mean, he is a tough, tough guy. You know, that combination of Richardson and Wilkerson in with the Jets is, you know, this is maybe the best pairing of defensive ends in a long time in, you know, in the National Football League, in that kind of 3-4 system. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, with these guys, Rex, whose dad, you know, was the father of the 46 and, you know, the Bear defense and all that, they play a bunch of fronts. I mean, they're multiple. So those two guys are kind of what we talked about, that unique cat who can play both in a 4-3 scheme and be a single-gap player and then also, you know, jump in there and play some two-gap. They're big enough and strong enough, but good enough athletes. So they're rare guys. Campbell, to me, is a guy that suffers from playing in Arizona. And what I mean by that is you just don't hear about the Arizona Cardinals that much. That's starting to change a little bit. Mm-hmm. But if Calais Campbell was playing, you know, with the Packers, or he was playing in, you know, with the Patriots or any of the, quote, teams, the more hyped teams in the National Football League,
yeah,
I think a lot of people would stand up and take notice. It's interesting that, you know, you would hear another player single him out. And that's a good endorsement, if you will, for, you know, Calais Campbell. I'm going to take a little journalistic license and just stick Ndamukong Suh at defensive end, because when you kick him over and when you watch some of the unique things that Detroit would do with him, and I think Miami, this is really going to be intriguing to see what Miami does with him, is you don't need to play him inside all the time.
No.
If you've got another big guy in there, which they had with Fairley, you can kick him out and actually get him on a tackle or get him on the outside shoulder of a guard, which is, you know, kind of more into that 3-4 sunk down system that the Steelers play. So I think he would be, just as a 3-4 guy, well, I would look at him and I'd go, if he's available in the draft, I'm gonna take him, and he's gonna be a dynamite tight end side defensive end in the 3-4. But these guys are big, strong, every single one of them, big, strong, nasty, tough football players. And that's the job description, I guess you would, if you would, of a 3-4 defensive end.
Yeah, Miami might do that quite a bit because they've got C.J. Mosley who can play defensive tackle. They got Earl Mitchell from Houston last year who can play nose tackle. So you could see Ndamukong Suh playing at defensive end if they're multiple up front and switching things around. And I guess that's what Baltimore did for a number of years with Haloti Ngata, didn't they, Jeff? I mean, he looks like an interior lineman, but he's not really.
No, well, he can play all and up and down the line. And again, I think when you look at those kinds of guys, and when you have those special guys, why not move them around? Why not put them in particular situations where you can get the most out of them? Mm. So, for example, you know, if you're the Dolphins, you know you've got edge pass rushers. You've got guys that can get up the field and create havoc off the edge. Now, take a guy like Suh, and every offensive line has a weakness. Every offensive lineman has a, something that they struggle against. And in the National Football League, if you have a weakness, people are going to go after it every week. So, for example, if you're an offensive lineman that doesn't handle the bull rush very well, hey, I'm going to put in Ndamukong Suh on that guy every passing situation and just let him go to work. Mm. So these kinds of guys with that kind of flexibility, they earn every penny that they make. And I am really, really excited to see, what new things we're going to see out of Ndamukong Suh and out of the Dolphins when he's down there this year.
Another couple of guys I'll just throw into the mix, and I don't think they've really got positions, which is why, what you're saying, Jeff, about you need to take a bit of journalistic license when coming up with this list. I think somebody like Jarrell Casey of the Tennessee Titans at first glance might look like a defensive tackle but gets a lot of sacks. And the same with Cedric Marks of the Jacksonville Jaguars. I think both of those guys could fit that, you could describe them as guys who move inside at times, but also you could get production out of them in defensive end if you were in that kind of front.
No, I'm going to tell you something. And here's another guy that, in my opinion, he doesn't play in that system, but if you put him in that system, he would be a really, really dangerous cat. And that's Michael Bennett from Seattle.
Yeah.
You watch him in their scheme. He's playing everywhere from nose to, outside on the tight end. So because he is so athletic and so big, so strong, so fast, such a great pass rusher, imagine him in the 3-4 where you allowed him to really cut it loose. He could do that, no question. And again, those are the guys that when you go into the scouting combine and you start looking at tape in college football, you're looking for those guys all the time. It's interesting, the way that defense in the last 15 years has really changed, and how much more they're asking of, defensive linemen. There are fewer and fewer guys who can only do one thing left in the National Football League. Those first down guys that the Reuben Browns, if you remember him from the Packers.
Yeah.
That,
yeah, yeah.
You talk about a space eater inside. He'd take up all those gaps in there just because he was that big. And then, when it got to be pass rush time, they'd get him off the field and stick him back out there on first down again. So, I think the wave of the game is changing, and I think bodies are starting to change in the National Football League. If you've watched, and I'm sure, Neil, as you go to training camps, you've seen how defensive linemen now are becoming more and more angular, longer, more, narrow hip, really better athletes, frankly, than they were 10, 12 years ago.
Yeah, no, I think that's definitely the case. You're seeing it change. Like you say, athlete is the key word, Jeff. They want players that if they get caught in space, they can do something about it. So that's our defensive end, so 3-4. Jeff, why don't we double up next week? So I think it's probably going to be relatively quiet on the news front. Let's do our 4-3 defensive ends and the best defensive tackles in the NFL. So 5 of each, yeah?
You got it. You got it. I'm looking forward to it.
All right, let's finish off with our mailbag on this week's Inside the Huddle. And, Jeff, this is a good question, actually, to start. It comes from Steve, who said, Jeff, what's the main focus of a special teams coordinator in camp? Is it to get college stars to accept special teams roles? So you can talk about the role of a coordinator in camp in a moment, Jeff, but that's an interesting aspect, isn't it? What's that been like for you when you get this guy who was a big man on campus, suddenly gets to the pros? Well, you better be able to play some special teams as well.
Yeah, you know what? It's an interesting transition that a player has to make. We have one of our running backs here, C.J. Gable, who was the first. Now, you talk about an honor. He was the first freshman ever to start at tailback at USC. Now, there's been some pretty good tailbacks
Gone
through USC. O.J. Simpson, Mike Garrett, yada, yada, yada,
Reggie
going through
Bush.
There. Reggie Bush. I mean, there are lots of them that have been Pro Bowlers. And, imagine taking that kid, and then he comes to pro football, and he's covering kicks, and he's playing on a punt return team, and he's trying to learn to be a pro football player, playing in a system that in special teams that he's never played in before, because he was a starter from the first minute he walked on the campus. Now he was a kick returner, but when he had to do the other stuff, fullback on the punt team and all, it's a tough transition. And what the biggest thing to me that a special teams coach has to do, and I did an interview yesterday, and they talked about Ron Zook becoming the special teams coordinator in Green Bay and how Green Bay special teams have really struggled over the years. The biggest thing that you have to do is you have to create a culture inside the meeting room first and then on the field that it's important, that it's critical for the football team, and that your role is no less important than this, let's say, the starting wide receiver. We say to our kids here that if you want to be on the starting defensive unit, then you want to play on the kickoff team because that's the first defensive down of every game. And you want to be on the punt cover unit because that's the first defensive down of every series when we go down and cover punts. So if you're a young kid, it gives you an opportunity to have a place of honor, if you will, on the football team. And it's constantly selling to the entire team. When we go to a special teams meeting, the entire team is in that meeting. Now, some of those guys don't play one snap of special teams, but you want them in there because you want to highlight the importance of the role of those other guys that are playing special teams, and you need to see how they play. And I think the really good special teams coaches that I've been around are the guys that can create by the team that special teams is important. And a lot of that comes from the head coach. The head coach has to support you. I know in our special teams meetings in Kansas City, Coach Vermeil sat in every single special teams meeting. Everyone.
Well, it puts that emphasis on it, doesn't it, Jeff? Because we hear that cliche, it's a third of the game. And I've seen it on practice fields. When I went to watch Andy Reid's Philadelphia Eagles, when Andy Reid was still in Philadelphia, the depth of preparation that went into special teams was pretty astounding, considering it was training camp. You know, 15 minutes kicking onside kicks, 15 minutes of kick return. I mean, there was a big chunk of this practice session that I watched which was donated to special teams. But from what you're saying, it sounds like it's still a job that the coaches have to kind of sell to the players in the NFL or in any professional football, each and every week, to re-emphasize it.
I say it like this. Hey, any kid or any player that has a football card, right? And they all want to have, that's one of the biggest things that about being a pro. When the guy comes and he shoots your picture and you got to fill out this form and you get a football card, right?
Yep.
The kind of kids collect and people collect and I've yet to see one guy on his football card say Neil Reynolds guard punt team. It's going to say Neil Reynolds tight end or Neil Reynolds linebacker. It's not going to say Neil Reynolds R5 on the kickoff team.
Right.
So they don't think of themselves as special teams players first, although for a lot of guys, that will be their role. Chris Banjo, who played for me who I recruited and played for me at SMU, is now in his third year with the Packers. And, he plays maybe in a season 15 plays at safety,
so he'll
play 35 special teams plays every game.
So he wouldn't be in the NFL if it wasn't for that.
Absolutely, and he knows that. He knows his role is going to be, because he's not big enough, he's not fast enough, he's not a lot of things enough as a starting defensive player. But as a special teams player, he makes a major contribution to that football team. So, those are the guys, maybe one of the best special teams players ever in the history of the National Football League was Steve Tasker from the Bills.
Absolutely.
And his son Luke plays for us here. And is pretty doggone good special teams player himself. But Steve, I see Steve at our games, and we've had a chance to sit and have a couple beers and talk. And, he said to me, he said, Jeff, I'm just going to tell you, I would have never even made it in the National Football League if it wasn't for my ability to play on special teams. And he hung around for a dozen years. And actually, he's one of the only guys whose name comes up on the ballot for the Hall of Fame every year. And he made his name as a special teams player for the Buffalo Bills.
He's one of those exceptions, Jeff, where you say that it doesn't say on the football card special teams player. I challenge people to tell me the position Steve Tasker played in the NFL. I mean, there will be not many will remember him as a as a special teams star for the Buffalo Bills, blocking punts, doing everything on special teams. Did we ever see him at wide receiver? Rarely.
Very, very rarely. And Steve will tell you that too. As, you know, and you walk. I tell you, it's amazing when you meet him, and he's a great guy. I mean, a great guy. And but you meet him, and he's not much bigger than me. And you look at him, and you go, he looks more like an accountant than a football player. And but when he was playing, I'm telling you now, he was. You had to know where he was at all the time.
Always, absolutely. Another special teams related question, Jeff, comes from Gary Pugh, who says, how important is it to have a specialized punter and kicker? Could a team not use one player to do both, therefore freeing up space on the roster?
Well, that's an interesting one that we've gone through right here with our football team. You know, we have a kicker who's very, very good, very accurate. He's 7 for 7. You know, field goals this year was 90% last year. A kid named Justin Medlock, who was actually a third-round draft pick in the National Football League. And you know, we tried for 2 years to have him do both jobs. But, you know, he struggled with his punting. So, you know, this past week we brought in a punter, just created, you know, a spot on a roster for a punter because, you know, that's such a critical part of the, you know, field position game. And the reason why there have been very, very few that have ever been able to do both is the leg swing is so different between the two types of kicking. When you kick a field goal or kick off, the leg swing is more across like a soccer kicker swings. So, but your leg swing when you punt is vertical, straight up and down. And so, it's very, very, it's really rare that a guy can be really good at both of those two things. And you got to go back a long time in the NFL to think of a guy that could do, you know, both of those things accurately. Now, Thomas Morstead from the Saints.
Yeah,
kicks off, and he's a tremendous kickoff guy and also punts, but Thomas is not as good as they need as a field goal guy because of accuracy issues. And so if you just ask him to go back there and line up and put the ball on the tee and kick it into the end zone for a touchback, he's your guy. Mm. But if you ask him to put it in a specific spot on the field, he's not accurate enough for them to, you know, as a field goal guy. But as a punter, again, same thing. He's got a big leg. He's not a directional punter, but he's a guy that can hang it up in the air. So, you know, it's a very finite skill, and to be frank with you, they're all wacky, they're all crazy, out of their mind guys, and I try and stay away from them as much as I can because I'm afraid it'll rub off on me.
You're their coach. You can't stay away from them. One more question here.
You know what? I do. I tell them, I say, hey, you know what? Just go over there and whatever you need to do, you know,
be ready.
A seance. Get your QP doll out, as long as it's not me. Whatever you need to do, you know, like burn a chicken. I don't know what you guys do to get ready to play. Just get yourself ready to play.
Do you know what kickers and punters do from what I've seen in training camp? They talk a lot. They stand around. They mess about with footballs.
God.
They stand around, mess about with footballs, and they come on and do 5 minutes at the end. But they're ready.
Oh my God. It's unbelievable. It is unbelievable. I have to shield my eyes. I'm serious. Medlock works like crazy. I mean, he works like crazy. He got to almost temper him back a little bit because he wants to kick so much.
Right.
But I'm going to tell you what, it's like a knitting circle over there. The long snapper, that's all he does.
Yeah.
The holder, the punter and the kicker. And it's just like, they never have their helmet on. Right?
They're excellent at bouncing footballs to each other. You know when they walk around bouncing a football and it bounces straight back up into their hand?
It is unbelievable. And then if the wind starts to blow, right, all it takes to
head indoors.
Let the wind start to blow, and all of a sudden now we got major issues. Now there's drama on the field.
Kickers. Last question, Jeff. This comes from Thomas Aldersley, who says, cricket has all-rounders. Why don't more NFL players play offense and defense, again, thus creating greater squad depth? And we saw J.J. Watt do it a little bit last year. But, Jeff, they're very different sports, aren't they? In cricket, you only have 11 players to choose from, so you want some versatility in your players. In the NFL, you can dress 46 players every Sunday, so you can afford to have specialist players.
Yeah, and, you know, you can. But I'm going to tell you something. I think who sent that question?
That was from Thomas Aldersley.
Thomas is, I'm telling you, you may be on the cutting edge because you're starting to see it creep into the league now because of the need for depth, frankly.
Yeah.
You're starting to see guys playing, you know, if you go back in history books a little bit, you know, and at once it became platoon football where you had an offensive defense, then it became specializing player. When Deion Sanders came into the league and was drafted number one at Atlanta out of Florida State, June watched Deion go through ball drills and you know, they knew he could run. And he said to Jerry, "Hey, give me Deion for a little package. I'm just going to put him at receiver and give him a little package," because he was a great punt returner. He was really good with the ball in his hands. Mm. And all he taught him was a flat route. Right? But they put him in there and they'd throw the flat route to him and off he'd go, right? So you've seen some guys like that over time that could go out and play a little wide receiver or a wide receiver, you know, the brown kid out of the Patriots a couple years ago. Yep. that you know, played wide receiver. Mm-hmm. You've seen
Devin Hester's
Edelman go over and play some corner. Devin Hester's been on both sides of the ball. You're starting to see guys, you know, kind of doing a little bit of that. You see in short yardage, you see the defensive lineman coming over to play tight end.
Yes.
Or playing fullback in the backfield. So I think that's coming in the league. And as is normally the case, one of the teams that's probably at the forefront of that is the Patriots. You know, you remember Mike Vrabel was a threat as a tight end in goal line situations. So, you know, I if you can get a guy that can do that, then I think that's really beneficial because, you know, we're going into a game this Thursday and we don't have a backup American defensive back. And, you know, again, if somebody gets hurt, I don't know what we're going to do. But right now on our roster, we've got so many guys hurt, we don't have a spot for a backup American defensive back. And you know, that makes it tough. So we've actually taken a receiver and just cross-trained him a little bit this week.
Yeah.
So if we got in an emergency situation, he could go over and do it.
Yeah, I mean, let's look at the Jets. I mean, go back to the 3-4 defensive ends. Sheldon Richardson was telling me when I interviewed him last month that, you know, he enjoys being the, you know, when they go goal line or they're short yardage, he likes playing fullback and he wants more of those opportunities. Now, if he can do that and he excels and it's only, you're asking him to do it 2, 3, 4 plays a game and it's not going to risk injury to him, you don't have to carry a fullback on your roster then.
Yeah, and you know, you look deeper into your roster and, you know, I know when I was at training camp in Kansas City in 01, our long snapper was a guy named Kendall Gammon, who was a really outstanding long snapper, and they were training him to be the third tight end in three tight end situations because he had played tight end in college. Now, he was never going to be a starting tight end in the NFL, but if you can get a guy that can do that, that's one roster spot freed up. So if you could have your long snapper be your third tight end, then that's a benefit because now you've got another roster spot you can put somewhere else. So at the bottom of your roster, anybody who can bring you flexibility where you could be a 2 or 3 position guy really does help you.
Excellent. Good stuff, Jeff. That is everything we've got time for this week on Inside Off. Jeff, we've got to get you off to coach those guys you don't like hanging around with.
No.
We like some of them.
I do like some of them. Not very many of them, but I like a couple of them.
All right, so this has been Inside the Huddle in association with SkySports.com and NFL UK. We thank you for joining us this week and for your continued support of our podcast. We enjoy bringing it to you every week. Jeff, until next week, say goodbye to the good folks.
Aloha.